You can repay that, I suppose. There's no need. Connie Duane stood in the doorway. They all turned at the sound of her voice. You have money of mine in this project. When Uncle John got it from me, he told me it was a real estate speculation. His other activities have been honest and practical, so I did not investigate. Now I have. I shall withdraw my money, and you can pay me less the sum advanced to Captain Kedrick. He may repay me when circumstances permit it. All in the room were still. Gunter's face was pale, and Keith looked startled, then angry. He started to protest, but he was too slow. Berwick turned on Gunter.
You,
he snorted angrily.
You told me that was your money. Oh, you fool. What do you mean, bringing a woman into a deal like this? Well, you brought her in. Now you manage her or I shall.
Nobody, Connie replied, is managing me or my affairs from now on. I'll handle them myself. She turned to Kedrick. I'm glad, Captain, that you've made this decision. I'm sure you'll not be sorry for it. Kedrick turned to follow her from the room, but Berwick's voice stopped him.
Captain!
He turned. Keith's eyes were ugly, and Gunter's face was haunted by doubt and fear.
Captain Kedrick, Berwick said. I believe we are being too hasty. I like your caution in this matter. Your suggestion that cleaning out those people might make trouble and cause talk in Washington is probable. I had considered that, but not knowing McLennan, had considered the chance negligible. Slagle, I know. McLennan, I do not know. Your suggestion eliminates a frontal attack. We must try some other means. Also, he added, I believe that your presence has some claim on that of Miss Duane. Consequently, as we can brook no failure now, I have a proposition for you. How would you like to come into the firm? As a silent partner.
Keith's face flushed angrily. The Gunter looked up, his eyes suddenly hopeful. Berwick continued.
We could give you a 15% interest, which, believe me, will be adequate. I believe you could keep Miss Duane in line, and with you at the helm, we might straighten this whole thing out. Without bloodshed.
Kedrick hesitated. The money was a temptation, for he had no desire to be indebted to Connie. Yet the money alone would mean nothing. It was that last phrase that gripped his attention and made him incautious. Without bloodshed, he repeated. On those terms, I accept. However, let's discuss this matter a bit further. Keith spun on his heel.
Berwick, this doesn't make sense. You know, the only way we'll get these people off is by driving them off. We agreed on that before. Also, this man is not reliable. I happen to know that he has friends on the other side, and has actually been in communication with them.
So much the better.
Berwick pursed his fat lips and mopped perspiration from his face.
He'll have a contact he can use then to make a deal.
He chuckled.
Suppose you two run along and let me talk to Captain Kedrick.
Hours later, Tom Kedrick paused on the street and studied it with care. Berwick had been more than reasonable, little as he was able to trust him, yet he thought it possible that Berwick was sincere in his agreement to buy off a few of them and to try to convince others. Certainly, if the government moved in, they would have to move anyway. With McLennan and Slagle out of the picture, the chances were there would be no fight, for the others lacked leadership. No fighting meant no deaths, and the settlers would come out of it with a little money at least. He paced the street irritably, avoiding company. Berwick stank of deceit, but the man was practical, and he should realize that a sudden mass of killings preceding the sale of the land would create a furor that might cause them to lose out all around. At least trouble had been avoided for the time, and even Connie was hopeful that something might be done. Tomorrow he was returning again to try to make some deal with McLennan and Slagle. A neutral messenger was leaving tonight.
They won't come to town, Berwick had agreed. So why not pick some intermediate point? Meet them, say, at Largo Canyon or Chimney Rock. Have your talk there, and I'll come with you. Just you and me, McLennan and Slagle. We can talk there and maybe make peace. Ain't it worth a try?
It was only that chance for peace that had persuaded him and helped him to persuade Connie. She had listened in silence as he explained the situation. Then she had turned to him frankly. Captain, you don't trust them, and neither do I. Uncle John has never been this way before, and I believe somehow he has fallen under the domination of those other men. However, I think that if Berwick is willing to talk, we should at least agree. I'll stand by you in this, and we'll hope something can come of it that will prevent trouble. Kedrick was less hopeful than he had let it appear, and now he was studying the situation from every angle. As things stood, it was a stalemate. He was confident that with McLennan and Slagle to lead them, the settlers could manage a stiff defense of their town and their homes. Certainly, they could prevent the survey being completed and prevent any use being made of the lands. Yet there were fiery elements on both sides, and Keith did not like the turn things had taken. Colonel Loren Keith had from the very beginning planned on striking fast and wiping out the opposition. It would be merely another unsolved mystery of the West. Kedrick resolved to keep an eye on the man and be prepared for anything. He returned to the St. James and to bed, yet he awakened early and was surprised to see Keith mounted and riding out of town at daybreak. With a bound, he was out of bed and dressing. Whatever Keith had in mind, he meant to know. Swiftly, he descended the stairs and went to the livery stable. Mounted, he headed out of town, found Keith's tracks with ease, and followed them. Keith turned off the trail and headed west and slightly north, but after a few miles, Kedrick lost the trail and took a wide swing to try and cut it again, but Keith had vanished somewhere in the vicinity of Largo Canyon. Returning to the hotel, he found a message from Bob McLennan. He and Slagle would meet with Berwick and Kedrick at Chimney Rock at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. It was now Monday, and a whole day lay between. Yet, during the remainder of Monday, he saw nothing of Dorney Shaw, although Laredo Shad appeared a couple of times, then vanished into one of the saloons. At midnight, the door of his room opened slowly, and Tom Kedrick sat up, gun in hand. It was Laredo Shad.
"Something's up," he said, dropping on the bed, "and she looks mighty peculiar. A couple of hours ago, Poinsett and Goff showed up and said they had quit. No fighting here, so they were pulling out for Durango. About a half hour later, they mounted up and took off." "What's peculiar about that?" Kedrick inquired, building a smoke. "That's in line with Berwick's talk with me."
"Yeah," Shad replied dryly. "But both of them came in here with a good deal of gear. They lost their pack horses somewheres and went out only with what they could carry on the one horse, and damned little of that."
"What about Fessenden?"
"I ain't seen him."
"Any of the others gone?"
"Clausen is. At least, he ain't around in sight. I ain't seen him since morning."
That left Shaw, who had been around little himself, and Fessenden, if he was still in town. Despite himself, Kedrick was disturbed, but if Berwick was getting rid of his warriors, it was a good sign. And probably, Kedrick felt, he was getting too suspicious. Nothing, Shad said, had been said to him about quitting.
"In fact," Shad said dryly, "the Mixus boys pulled in this morning, and they went right to Berwick."
"Who are they?"
"Killers. Dry gulchers, mostly. Bean and Abe Mixus. They were in that Sandoval affair. Couple of men died awful opportune in that affair, and come to think of it, Berwick was around. Fact is, that was where I met him."
"Were you in that?"
"Uh-huh. I was in town, though, and had me a run-in with Roy Gangle. Roy was a mighty tough ranny who'd been ramrodding a big spread down that way, and when he got into the war, he went bad. Plumb bad. We'd had trouble over a steer, and he braced me. He was a mite slow."
It made no sense. Gunmen leaving, but others arriving. Of course, the Mixus boys could have been spoken to before the change of plans. That must be it. He suggested as much to Laredo, and the Texan nodded dubiously.
Maybe. I don't trust that hombre none. Your man Gunter is in over his head. Keith? Well, he's all around bad when it comes to that. But neither of them can hold a candle to that Berwick.
Study the situation as he could, Tom Kedrick could see no answer to it, and the fact remained that they were to meet Slagle and McLennan for a peace conference. Out of that, anything might come, and he had no real cause to distrust Berwick. Morning was bright and clear, with the sun promising a hot day. Yet it was still cool when Kedrick appeared on the street and crossed to the little restaurant where he ate in silence. He was on his second cup of coffee when Connie came in. Her face brightened with a smile as she saw him, and she came over to his table. You know, you're the one bright spot in this place. I'm so tired of that old stone house and seeing that dirty old man around that I can scarcely stand it. I'll be glad when this is all over. He studied her.
What will you do then?
You know, I've not really thought of that. What I want to do is to get a ranch somewhere, a place with trees, grass, and some running water. It doesn't have to be a big place.
Cattle?
A few, but horses are what I want. Horses like that one of yours, I think.
Good idea. It takes less land for horses, and there's always a market for good stock.
He studied the beauty of her mouth, the quietness and humor of her eyes.
Somehow I'm glad to think you're staying. It wouldn't be the same without you.
Not now. She looked at him quickly, her eyes dancing with laughter, but with a hint of a question in her depths. Why, Tom, that sounds almost like gallantry. Like you were trying to make love to me, like all the cowboys.
No, Connie, he said quietly. When I make love to you, there won't be any doubt about it. You'll know, and I won't be fooling. Over west of here, west and south, there's a great rim that stretches for miles across the country, and a splendid pine forest atop it. There's trees, water, game, and some of the finest mountain meadows a man ever saw. I know a place over there where I camped once. A good spring, some tall trees, graceful in the wind, and a long sweep of land clear to the rim's edge. And beyond it, miles upon miles of rolling, sweeping range and forest.
It sounds fascinating, like what I've been wanting ever since I came west. He pushed back his chair and stood up.
Maybe when this is over, you'd ride over that way with me? I'd like to show it to you.
She looked up at him. All right, Tom. We'll look at it together. He paused, hat in hand, staring out the door.
Together, he mused. Then he glanced down at her. You know, Connie, that's the most beautiful word in the language. Together.
He walked away then, pausing to pay his check and hers, before stepping outside into the warmth of the street. A buckboard had stopped, and a man was getting out of it, a man who moved warily and looked half-frightened. He glanced around swiftly, then ducked through the door into the store. 8. Two men crossed the street suddenly. One of them was a man Kedrick had never seen before. The other was a sly-looking loafer he had seen hanging around the back door in the saloon at Yellow Butte. The loafer, a sour-faced man called Singer, was talking. They stopped, and he indicated the buckboard to the man with him.
That's him, Abe, Singer was saying. He's one of that crowd from across the way. He's brother-in-law to McLennan.
This is a good place to start, Abe replied shortly, low-voiced. Let's go.
Tom Kedrick turned on his heel and followed them. As they stepped into the door, he stepped after and caught it before it slammed shut. Neither man seemed to be aware of his presence, for they were intent on the man at the counter.
Hello, Sloan, Singer said softly. Meet Abe Mixis.
The name must have meant something to Sloan, for he turned, his face gray. He held a baby's bottle that he was in the act of buying in his right hand. His eyes, quick and terror-stricken, went from one to the other. He was frightened and puzzled, and he seemed to be fighting for self-control.
You in this squabble, Singer? I figure you'd be outside of it.
Singer chuckled.
That's what I aim for folks to think.
Mixis, a lean, stooped man with yellow eyeballs
and a thin-cheeked face, drew a paper from his pocket. "That's a quick claim deed, Sloan," he said. "You can sign it and save yourself trouble." Sloan's eyes went to the deed and seemed to hold there. Then, slowly, they lifted. "I can't do that. My wife's having a child in the next couple of days. I worked too hard on that place to give it up. I reckon I can't sign."
"I say you better."
Mixus's voice was cold, level. The storekeeper had vanished, and the room was empty save for the three and for Tom Kedrick, standing in the shadows near some hanging jeans and slickers.
"I say you better sign, because you don't own that property anyhow. Want to call me a liar?"
Resolution seemed to have overcome Sloane's immediate fear. He was a brave man, and Kedrick knew that whatever he said now, he would die. He spoke first. "No, Abe," he said softly. "I'll call you a liar." Mixus stiffened as if struck. He was a killer and dangerous, but he was a smart, sure-thing killer. And he had believed himself alone but for Singer. Now somebody was behind him. He stood, stock still, then started to turn. Singer had fallen back against the wall, his eyes starting to locate Kedrick. "It's Kedrick," he said. "The boss gunman." Mixus scowled.
"What's the matter?" he said irritably. "What you buttin' in for?"
"There's to be no more killing, Abe." Kedrick held his ground. "We're having a peace conference tomorrow. This killing is over."
"Got my orders," Mixus persisted. "You talk to Berwick."
There was a movement from Sloan, and he whirled on him.
"You stand still," he barked.
"You can go, Sloan," Kedrick said. "Get in your outfit, and tell McLennan that my word is good. You'd better stop thinking about him, Abe. You're in trouble, and I'm in trouble." Mixus was confused. He knew Kedrick was ramrodding the gunman for the company, and he was puzzled. Had he been about to do the wrong thing? But no, he hadn't.
"You fool!"
His confusion burst into fury.
"Keith told me to get him!"
"Shut up!"
Singer yelled.
"Damn it, you—"
Abe Mixus was a cold-blooded killer, and no heavyweight mentally. Orders and counter-orders had come to him, and worked up to such a killing pitch, he had been suddenly stopped in the middle of it, and switched off into this back trail where he floundered hopelessly. Now, Singer seemed to be turning on him, and he swung toward him, his teeth bared, his face vicious.
"Don't you tell me, you white-livered coyote," he snarled.
One hand hung over a gun, and Singer, frightened, grabbed for his own gun. Instantly, Mixus whipped out his .44 and flame stabbed at Singer. The renegade turned on his heel, his knees slowly buckled and he slid to the floor, his head against a sack of flour, blood welling from his mouth. Mixus stared down at him, and then, slowly, he blinked. Then blinked again. Awareness seemed to return to him, and his jittery nerves calmed. He stared down at Singer, almost unbelieving.
"Why, killed Singer," he said.
"That's right." Kedrick was watching him, knowing now upon what a slender thread of irritation this man's muscles were poised.
"What will Keith say to that?"
Cunning came over Abe's horse-like face.
"Keith? What gave you the idea he had anything to do with this?"
he demanded. Slowly, attracted by the shooting and made confident by its end, people were gathering in front of the door. The storekeeper had come into the room and stood watching, his face drawn and frightened. Tom Kedrick took a slow step back as Abe's eyes turned toward the front of the store. Putting the slickers between them, he moved on cat feet to the opening between the counters and slid through into the living quarters and out into the alley behind the store. Crossing the street below the crowd, he wound up in front of the St. James, pausing there. Laredo Shad materialized beside him.
"What happened?"
he asked swiftly. Kedrick explained.
"I don't get it," he said. "Keith may be moving on his own, but Berwick was to hold off until we had our talk. And I know Keith didn't like that. He spoke right up about it."
"Ain't Singer supposed to be a settler?" Shad asked. "Won't this serve to get 'em all riled up? Who knew that Singer was with Keith in the company?"
You've got a point there, Kedrick said thoughtfully. This may be the very thing that will blow the lid off. Both of them were mighty jumpy. It looked like they had Sloan marked because he was McLennan's relative. I sprung a surprise on him, and Mixus just couldn't get himself located. The crowd separated, then gathered in knots along the street to discuss the new event. Shad loitered there beside him, and was standing there when Lauren Keith came up. He glanced sharply at Shad, then at Kedrick.
What's happened over there?
He kept his eyes on Kedrick as he spoke, and Kedrick shrugged.
Shooting, I guess. Not unusual for Mustang, from what I hear.
Mixus was in there, Shad commented. Wonder if he had a hand in it.
Keith turned and looked at Laredo, suspicion in his eyes.
Who was shot?
He inquired, his eyes going from one to the other.
Singer, they tell me, Shad said casually. I reckon Mixus killed him.
Mixus? Killed Singer?
Keith shook his head.
That's preposterous.
Don't know why, Laredo drawled. Mixus come here to fight, didn't he? And ain't Singer one of them settlers?
Colonel Keith hesitated, his sharp, hard features a picture of doubt and uncertainty. Watching him, Kedrick was amused and pleased. The storekeeper had not seen him, and it was doubtful if anyone had but Mixus, the dead man, and the now-missing Sloan. What Abe Mixus would offer as an explanation for shooting Singer, Tom couldn't conceive. But a traitor had died, and the enemy was confounded. Little as it might mean in the long run, it was for the moment a good thing. The only fly in the ointment was the fact that Singer had been a squatter, and that few, if any, knew of his tie-up with Keith and the company. Watching the crowds in the street, Tom Kedrick began to perceive a new element shaping itself. Public opinion was a force Berwick had not reckoned with, and the faces of the men talking in the streets were hard and bitter. These were mostly poor men who had made their own way or were engaged in making their way, and they resented the action of the company. Few had known Singer well, and those few had little use for the man, but the issue, from their viewpoint, was not a matter of personalities, but a matter of a bunch of hard-working men against the company, an organization largely of outsiders seeking to profit from the work of local people. Furthermore, whatever Singer was, he was not a gunman, and he was a local man. Abe Mixus was a known killer, a gunman whose gun was for hire. Tom Kedrick nodded toward the street.
Well, Colonel, he said, you'd better start thinking about that, unless you want to stretch hemp. That bunch is sore.
Keith stared at them nervously, then nodded and hurried away toward headquarters. Shad watched him go and turned toward Kedrick.
You know, we're sort of tied in with the company, and I don't want to hang for him. Let's light a shuck out of here and stick in the hills for a few days.
Can't. I've got to make that meeting with Berwick. But you might get out of town anyway. Scout around and see what you can find of Goff and them, if they really left the country or not. Meet me at Chimney Rock about 5 tomorrow evening. Make it later, about sundown.
Leaving Shad, Kedrick hurried to his room in the St. James and bundled his gear together. He carried it down to the livery stable and saddled the Appaloosa. When that was done, he headed for headquarters, staying off the main street. Yet it was Connie Duane he wanted to see, and not Berwick or Keith. There was no sign of any of them. Gunter was not around, and Berwick and Keith seemed to have vanished. Idling in the office, Tom heard a slight movement upstairs. He called out. Feet hurried along the floor above him, and then Connie was at the stairhead. Yes? Recognizing him, she hurried down. Is something wrong? Swiftly he explained, not holding anything back.
Nothing would come of it, although it wouldn't take much to start it, and they all know that the company gunmen are mostly out of town. Berwick, Keith, and your uncle must have lit out.
Uncle John hasn't been around all day. I saw him at breakfast, and then he disappeared.
I'll look around. Do you have a gun?
He shook his head then.
I don't much think you'll need it. Most of them like you around here, and you've been pretty outspoken. But stay close to your room. The lid's going to blow off.
He turned away, but she called to him, Tom! He turned when he reached the door. He seemed to see pleading in her eyes. Be careful, Tom. Their eyes held for a long moment, and then he nodded.
I will if I can.
He went out and paused on the steps. Berwick and Keith might get out of the way, but whatever else Gunter might be, he was scarcely the man to leave his niece behind at a time of danger. Puzzled that he should be this inconsistent, Kedrick paused and looked around him. The back street was bare and empty. The white, powdery dust lay thickly and had sifted into the foliage of the trees and shrubs. Kedrick hitched his guns into place and walked slowly around the house. The stable lay behind it, but it was usually filled with horses. Now it seemed empty. He strode back, his spurs jingling a little, and tiny puffs of dust rising from his boots as he walked. Once, nearly to the stable, he paused by a water trough and listened for noise from the town. It was quiet, altogether too quiet. He hesitated, worrying about Connie again, but then went on and into the wide door that gave entrance to the shadowed coolness of the stable. The stalls were empty, all save one. He walked back, then paused. The chestnut was Gunter's horse, and a saddle lay nearby. Could he be somewhere around town? Kedrick considered that, then dismissed it. He removed his hat and wiped the band with his kerchief, then replaced it. His face was unusually thoughtful, and he walked to the far end of the stable, examining every stall as he walked back. Nothing. Puzzled, he stepped out into the bright glare of the sun and heard no sound anywhere. He squinted his eyes around, then saw the ramshackle old building that had done duty for a stable before the present large one was built. He stared at it, and then turned in that direction. He had taken scarcely a step when he heard a rattle of hoofs and swung swiftly around, half-crouched, his hands wide. Then he straightened. Sue Lane slid from her horse and ran to him. "Oh, I found you, Tom," she cried, catching him by the arms. "Tom, don't go to that meeting tomorrow. There's going to be trouble."
"You mean McLennan's framed something?"
"McLennan?" For an instant, she was startled. "Oh, no, not Mac." Her expression changed. "Come home with me, Tom. Please do. Let them have this out and get it over with. Come home with me."
"Why all of a sudden worry about me?" He was sincerely puzzled. "We've met only once, and we seem to have different ideas about things."
"Don't stand there and argue. Tom, I mustn't be seen talking to you. Not by either side. Come with me and get away from here until this is all over. I've seen Dorney, and he hates you, Tom. He hates you."
"He does he?" He patted her arm. "Run along home now. I've things to do here."
"Oh?" Her eyes hardened a little. "Is it that woman? That Duane girl? I've heard all about her. How beautiful she is. How she... What kind of girl is she?"
"She's a lovely person," he said gravely. "You'd like her, Sue."
Sue stiffened. "Would I? I wonder how much you know about women, Tom. Or do you know anything about them? I could never like Connie Duane." She shook her arm. "Come if you're coming. I just heard this last night, and I won't see this happen."
"What? What's going to happen?"
She stamped her foot with impatience. "Oh, you fool, you. They plan to kill you, Tom. Now come on."
"Not now," he said quietly. "I've got to get this fight settled first. Then maybe I'll ride your way. Now, run along. I've got to look around."
Impatiently, she turned and walked to her horse. In the saddle, she glanced back at him. "If you change your mind..."
"Not now," he repeated.
"Then be careful. Be careful, Tom." He watched her go, then happened to glance toward the house. Connie Duane stood in the window, looking down at him. But as he looked up, she turned sharply away. He started for the house, then hesitated. There was nothing he could say now, nothing that would have any effect or do any good at all. He started toward the front of the house again, then stopped. On an impulse, he turned and walked swiftly back to the little old building and caught the latch. The door was weathered and gray. It creaked on rusty hinges and opened rheumatically. Inside, there was the musty odor of decay. Kedrick stood there for a minute, watching the sunlight filter through the cobwebbed window and fall in a faint square upon the ancient straw that littered the earthen floor. And then he stepped forward, peering around the corner of the nearest stall. John Gunter lay sprawled upon his face, his head pillowed upon one forearm, the back of his shirt covered with a dark white stain. Kedrick knelt beside him. Connie's uncle had been stabbed in the back. 3 powerful blows from the look of the wounds had been struck downward, evidently while he sat at a desk or table. He had been dead for several hours. 9. Alton Berwick, for all his weight, sat his saddle easily and rode well. His horse was a blood bay, tall and long-limbed. He walked it alongside Tom Kedrick's Appaloosa, and from time to time he spurred it to a trot, then eased down. On this morning, Berwick wore an ancient gray felt hat, torn at the flat crown, and a soiled handkerchief that concealed his greasy shirt collar. His shirt bulged over his belt, and he wore 1 gun too high on his hip for easy use. His whiskers seemed neither to have grown nor been clipped. They were still a rough stubble of dirty mixed gray. Yet he seemed unusually genial this morning.
Great country, Kedrick. Country for a man to live in. If this deal goes through, you should get yourself a ranch. I aim to.
Not a bad idea. Kedrick rode with his right hand dangling. I was talking about that yesterday, with Connie Duane. The smile vanished from Berwick's face.
You talked to her yesterday? At what time?
Afternoon. Kedrick let his voice become casual, yet he was alert to the change in Berwick's voice. Had Berwick murdered Gunter, or had it been one of the squatters? With things as they were, it would be difficult or impossible to prove. We had a long talk.
She's a fine girl.
Berwick said nothing, but his lips tightened. The Red Canyon walls lifted high above them. For along here, they were nearly 500 feet above the bottom of Salt Creek. There was but little farther to go, he knew, and he was puzzled by Berwick's increased watchfulness. The man might suspect treachery, but he had said nothing to imply anything of the kind. Tom's mind reverted to Sue's warning of the previous day. They intended to kill him. But who were they? She had not been specific in her warning except to say that he should not keep this rendezvous today. Kedrick turned the idea over in his mind, wondering if she were deliberately trying to prevent a settlement, or if she knew something and was genuinely worried. Pitt Lane, her gunslinging brother, was one element in the situation he could not estimate. Lane had not been mentioned in any of the discussions, and he seemed always just beyond reach, just out of sight, yet definitely in the background, as was the mysterious rider of the mouse-colored horse. That whole story seemed fantastic, but Kedrick did not think Sue was inclined to fall for tall stories. The canyon of Salt Creek widened out, and several branch canyons opened into it. They left the creek bed and rode closer together to the towering cliffs, now all of 700 feet above the trail. They were heading south, and Berwick, mopping his sweating face from time to time with a dirty handkerchief, was no longer talking. Kedrick pushed back his hat and rolled a smoke. He had never seen Berwick so jittery before, and he was puzzled. Deliberately, he had said nothing to any of the company about Gunter, although he had arranged with some of the townspeople to have the body moved. Tom was afraid it might precipitate the very trouble he was trying to end and bring the fight into open battle. Moreover, he was not at all sure of why Gunter had been killed or who had done it. That it could be retaliation for Singer's death was an answer to be considered, but it might have been done by either Keith or Berwick. He drew up suddenly, for a horse had left recent tracks coming in alone from the northwest. Berwick followed his eyes, studying the tracks.
I've seen those tracks before, Tom Kedrick said. Now, whose horse is that? We'd better step it up, Berwick said impatiently. They'll be there before us.
They pushed on into the bright, still morning. The sky overhead was a vast blue dome, scattered with fleecy puffballs of clouds, like bolts of cotton on the surface of a lake of pure blue. The red cliffs towered high on their left, and the valley on their right swept away in a vast, gently rolling panorama. Glancing off over this sagebrush-dotted valley, Tom knew that, lost in the blue haze,
some 7 or 8 miles away, was Malpias Arroyo and Sue Lane. Was she there this morning, or was she riding somewhere? She was strangely attractive, that slim, dark-haired, dark-eyed girl with her lovely skin, soft despite the desert sun and desert wind. She had come to him, riding all that distance to bring him a warning of danger. Why? Was it simply that she feared for him? Was she in love with him? He dismissed that idea instantly, but continued to wonder. She was, despite her beauty, a hard, calculating girl, hating the country around and wanting only to be free of it. Heat waves danced out over the bottomland, and shadows gathered under the red wall. A dust devil lifted and danced weirdly across the desert, then lost itself among the thick antelope brush and the cat claw. Tom Kedrick mopped his brow and swung his horse farther east. The tall spire of Chimney Rock lifted in the distance, its heavier, shouldered companion looming beside and beyond it.
Look! Berwick's voice held a note of triumph. There they come!
To the south, and still 3 or 4 miles off, they could see 2 riders heading toward Chimney Rock. At this distance, they could not be distinguished, but their destination was obvious.
Now that's fine, Berwick beamed. They'll be right here on time. Say,
he glanced at his heavy gold watch.
I tell you what, you'll be there a shade before them. So what say you wait for them while I have a look at a ledge up in the canyon?
In the shadow of the rock, Kedrick swung down. There was a small pool of water there. He let the Appaloosa drink, and ground hitched him deeper in the shade, near some grass. Then he walked back, and, dropping to the ground, lit a smoke. He could see the 2 riders nearing now. One was on a fast-stepping chestnut, the other a dappled gray. They rode up and swung down. The first man was Pete Slagle, the second a stranger who Kedrick had not seen before.
"Where's McLennan?" he asked.
"He'll be along. He hadn't come in from the ranch, so I came with Steelman here. He's a good man, and anything he says goes with all of us. Bob'll be along later, though, if you have to have his word."
"Berwick came. He's overlooking at a ledge he saw in the canyon over there."
The 3 men bunched, and Steelman studied Kedrick.
"Day Reed tells me you're a good man. Trustworthy, he says."
"I aim to be."
He drew a last drag on his cigarette and lifted his head to snap it out into the sand. For an instant, he stood poised, his face blank. Then, realization hit him.
"Look out!" he yelled. "Hit the dirt!"
His voice was drowned in a roar of guns, and something smashed him in the body even as he fell. Then, something else slugged him atop the head, and a vast wave of blackness folded over him, pushing him down, 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 deeper and deeper into a swirling darkness that closed in tightly around his body, around his throat. And then, there was nothing. Nothing at all. Alton Berwick smiled and threw down his cigar. Calmly he swung into the saddle and rode toward the 4 men who were riding from behind a low parapet of rocks near Chimney Rock. As he rode up, they were standing, rifles in hand, staring toward the cluster of bloody figures sprawled on the ground in the shade.
"Got 'em," Shaw said. His eyes were hard. "That cleans it up, and good."
Fessenden, Clausen, and Poinsett stared at the bodies, saying nothing. Lee Goff walked toward them from his vantage point, where he had awaited anyone who might have had a chance to escape. He stooped over the 3. Slagle was literally riddled with bullets, his body smashed and bloody. Off to one side lay Steelman, half the top of his head blown off. Captain Kedrick lay sprawled deeper in the shadow, his head bloody, and a dark stain on his body.
"Want I should finish him off for sure?"
Poinsett asked.
"Finish off what?"
Clausen sneered.
"Look at him. Shot to doll rags."
"What about Kedrick?" Fessenden asked. "He dead for sure?"
"Deader than Columbus," Goff said.
"Hey," Shaw interrupted. "This ain't McLennan. This here's that Joe Steelman."
They gathered around.
"Sure is,"
Berwick swore viciously.
"Now we're in trouble. If we don't get McLennan, we're,
His voice trailed away as he looked up at Dorney Shaw. The soft brown eyes were bright and boyish.
"Why, boss,
he said softly, dropping his cigarette and rubbing it out with his toe.
I reckon that's where I come in. Leave McLennan to me. I'll hunt him down before sun sets tomorrow.
Want company?
Poins had asked.
Don't need it, Shaw said. But come along. I hear this Bob McLennan used to be a frontier marshal. I never liked marshals, no way.
They drifted to their horses, then moved slowly away, joining Shaw, Poinsett, and Goff toward the west and Bob McLennan. Alton Berwick, his eyes thoughtful, rode toward the east and Mustang, and the others rode with him. Only Fessenden turned nervously and looked back.
We should have made sure they were dead.
Ride back if you want, Clausen said. They are dead all right. That Kedrick? I had no use for him. I aimed my shot right for his smart skull.
Afternoon drew on. The sun lowered, and after the sun came coolness. Somewhere a coyote lifted his howl of anguish to the wide white moon, and the desert lay still and quiet beneath the sky. In the deeper shadow of towering Chimney Rock and its bulkier neighbor, there was no movement. A coyote moved nearer, scenting the blood, but with it there was the dreaded man smell. He whined anxiously and drew back, then trotted off slowly, turning only once to look back. The Appaloosa, still ground-hitched, walked along the grass toward the pool, then stopped, nostrils wide at the smell of blood. Well down behind some rocks and brush, the shooting had only made it lift its head, then returned to cropping the thick green grass that grew in the tiny, sub-irrigated area around Chimney Rock. Nothing more moved. The coolness of the night stiffened the bodies of the men who lay sprawled there. 10 miles north, Laredo Shad, late for his meeting with Kedrick, limped along the trail, leading a badly lamed horse. 2 hours before, the trail along an arroyo bank had given way and the horse had fallen. The leg was not broken, but was badly injured. Shad swore bitterly and walked on, debating as he had for the past 2 hours on the advisability of camping for the night. But remembering that Kedrick would be expecting him, he pushed on. An hour later, still plodding and on blistered feet, he heard horses' hoofs and drew up, slipping his rifle into his hands. Then the rider materialized from the night, and he drew up also. For a long minute, no word was said. Then Shad spoke.
Name yourself, partner.
The other rider also held a gun.
Bob McLennan, he said. Who are you?
Laredo Shad. My horse lamed himself. I'm heading for Chimney Rock. Supposed to meet Kedrick there.
He stared at the rider.
Thought you was to be at the meeting. What happened?
I didn't make it. Stillman and Slagle went. I'm riding up here because they never come in.
What?
Shad's exclamation was sharp.
McLennan, I was right afeard of that. My bet is there's been dirty work. Never trusted that there Berwick, not no way.
McLennan studied the Texan, liking the man, but hesitant.
What's your brand read, Laredo? You a company man?
Shad shook his head.
Well, now it's like this. I come in here, drawing warrior pay to do some gunslinging, but I'm a right uppity sort of a gent about some things. This here don't size up right to me, nor to Kedrick. So we've been figuring on getting shut of the company. Kedrick only stayed on, hoping he could make peace. I stayed along with him.
Get up behind me, McLennan said. My horse will carry double, and it ain't far. 10. His eyes were open a long time before realization came, and he was lying in a clean, orderly place with which he was totally unfamiliar. For a long time he lay there, searching his memory for clues to tie all this together. He was Captain Tom Kedrick. He had gone west from New Orleans. He had taken a job. Then he remembered. There had been a meeting at Chimney Rock, and Steelman had come in place of McLennan, and then he had thrown his cigarette away, and had seen those men behind the rocks, seeing the sunlight flashing on their rifle barrels, actually. He had yelled, and then dropped, but not fast enough. He had been hit in the head, and he had been hit in the body at least once. How long ago was that?
He turned his head and found himself in a square stone room. One side of the room was native rock, and part of another side. The rest had been built up from loose stones gathered and shaped to fit. Besides the wide bed on which he lay, there was a table and a chair. He turned slightly, and the bed creaked. The door opened, and he looked up into the eyes of Connie Duane.
Connie.
He was surprised.
Where is this place? What happened?
You've been unconscious for days, she told him, coming to the bedside. You have had a bad concussion, and you lost a lot of blood before Laredo and Bog McLennan found you.
What about the others?
Both of them are dead, and by all rights you should have been.
But where are we? What is this place?
It's a cliff dwelling, a lonely one, and very ancient. It's high up on the side of the mountain called Thieving Rock. McLennan knew where it was, and he knew that if word got out that you were alive, they would be out to complete the job at once. So they brought you here. McLennan did, with Shad.
Are they still here?
Shad is. He hunts and goes to Yellow Butte for supplies, but he has to be very careful because it looked like they are beginning to get suspicious.
McLennan?
He's dead, Tom. Dorney Shaw killed him. He went to Mustang to find a doctor for you, and encountered Dorney on the street. Bob was very fast, you know, but Dorney is incredible. He killed Bob before he could get a shot off.
How did you get here?
Bob McLennan and Chad had talked about it, and also that Uncle John had been killed, so they came to me, and I came out here right away. I know a little about nursing, but not much. Laredo has been wonderful, Tom. He's a true friend. Kedrick nodded.
Who did the shooting? I thought it was Poinsett.
He was one of them. I heard them talking about it, but wasn't sure until later. Poinsett was there. Goff, Fessenden, Clausen, and Shaw.
Anything else happen?
Too much. They burned Yellow Butte Saloon and Livery Stable, and they have driven almost half the people off the land. Their surveyors are on the land now, checking the survey they made previously. A handful of the squatters have drawn back into the mountains somewhere, under Pitt Lane, and that friend of yours, Day Reed. They are trying to make a stand there.
What about Sue?
She looked at him quickly. You liked her, didn't you? Well, Sue has taken up with Keith. They are together all the time. He's a big man now. They brought in some more gunmen, and the Mixus boys are still here. Right now, Alton Berwick and Lauren Keith have this country right under their thumbs. In fact, they even called an election.
An election?
Yes, and they counted the ballots themselves. Keith was elected mayor and Fessenden as sheriff. Berwick stayed out of it, of course, and Dorney Shaw wouldn't take the sheriff's job.
Looks like they've got everything their own way, doesn't it?
He mused.
So, they don't know I'm alive?
No. Shad went back there and dug three graves. He buried the other two, and then filled in the third grave and put a marker over it with your name on it.
Good.
Kedrick was satisfied. He looked up at the girl.
And how do you get out here and back without them becoming curious?
She flushed slightly. I haven't been back, Tom. I stayed here with you. There was no chance of going back and forth. I just left everything and came away.
How long before I can be up?
Not long, if you rest, and you've talked enough now. Kedrick turned over the whole situation in his mind. There could be no more than a few days before the sale of the land would come off, and if there was one thing that mattered, it was that the company not be permitted to profit from their crookedness. As he lay there resting, a plan began to form in his mind, and the details supplied themselves one by one as he considered it. His guns hung on a nail driven into the wall close to hand. His duffel, which he had brought away from the St. James, lay in the corner. It was almost dark before he completed his planning, and when Laredo came in, he was ready for him.
Cimarron? Shad shook his head. Bloomfield would be nearer. How's that?
Good, Kedrick agreed. Make it fast.
That ain't worrying me, Laredo said,
rolling his tobacco in his jaws. They've been mighty suspicious lately. Suppose they trail this place down while I'm gone.
We'll have to chance that. Here's the message. Hurry it up.
The sun was bright in the room when Connie came through the door with his breakfast. She turned, and her face went white.
Oh, you're up.
He grinned shakily.
That's right. I've laid abed long enough. How long has it been?
Almost 2 weeks, she told him. But you mustn't stand up. Sit down and rest. There was a place by a window where he had a good view of the trail below. At his request, Connie brought the Winchester to him, and her own rifle. He cleaned them both, oiled them carefully, and placed them beside his window. Then he checked his guns and returned them to their holsters, digging the two Walsh Navy pistols from his duffel and checking them also. Thoughtfully, he considered. It was late to do anything now, but it was a wonder he had not thought of ransom before. No more able legislator existed in Washington than Frederick Ransom, and the two had been brother officers in the Civil War, as well as friends in France during the Franco-Prussian War, when Ransom had been there as an observer. If anybody could block the sale to the company, he could, even on such short notice. His telegram would be followed by a letter supplying all the details, and with that to go on, Ransom might get something done. He was a popular and able young senator with good connections and an affable manner. Moreover, he was an excellent strategist. It would make all the difference in this situation. The cliff dwelling was built well back from the face of the cliff and evidently constructed with an eye toward concealment as well as defense. They had called this, Connie told him, Thieving Rock, long before the white men appeared, and the Indians who lived here had been notorious thieves. There was a spring, so water was not a worry, and there were supplies enough for immediate purposes. 2 days dragged slowly by, and on the morning of the third, Kedrick was resuming his station by the window when he saw a rider coming into the narrow canyon below. The man was moving slowly and studying the ground as he came, although from time to time he paused and searched the area with careful eyes. Kedrick pushed himself up from his chair and, taking the Winchester, worked his way along the wall to the next room.
Connie, he called softly.
There was no reply, and after a minute he called a second time. Still no answer. Worried now, he remembered she had said something about going down below to gather some squaw cabbage to add greens to their diet. Back at the window, he studied the terrain carefully, and then his heart gave a leap, for Connie Duane was gathering squaw cabbage from a niche in the canyon wall, not 50 yards from the unknown rider. Lifting his rifle, Kedrick checked the range. It was all of 400 yards and a downhill shot. Carefully, he sighted on the rider. He was nearer the girl now, and a miss might ricochet and kill Connie, for the canyon wall would throw any bullet he fired back into the canyon itself, and might even ricochet several times in the close confines. Yet somehow, she had to be warned. If the rider saw her tracks, he would find both the girl and the hideout. Suddenly, the ears of his horse came up sharply, and the rider stiffened warily and looked all around. Carefully, Kedrick drew a bead on the man again. He hated to kill an unwarned man, but if necessary, he would not hesitate. Connie was standing straight now and appeared to be listening. Tense in every fiber, Tom Kedrick watched and waited. The two were now within 50 feet of each other, although each was concealed by a corner of rock and some desert growth, including a tall cottonwood and some cedars. Still listening, both stood rigidly, and Kedrick touched his lips with the tip of his tongue. His eyes blurred with the strain, and he brushed his hand across them. The rider was swinging to the ground now, and he had drawn a gun. Warily, he stepped out from his ground-hitched horse. Shifting his eyes to Connie, Tom saw the girl wave, and, lifting his hand, he waved back, then lifted the rifle. She waved a vigorous negation with her arm, and he relaxed, waiting. Now the man was studying tracks in the sandy bottom of the wash, and, as he knelt, his eyes riveted upon the ground, a new element entered the picture. A flicker of movement caught the tail of Kedrick's eye, and, turning his head, he saw Laredo Shad riding into the scene. He glanced swiftly at the window and waved his hand. Then he moved forward and swung to the ground.
From his vantage point, Kedrick could hear nothing, but he saw Laredo approach, making heavy going of it in the thick sand, and then, not a dozen yards from the man, he stopped. He must have spoken, for the strange rider stiffened, as if shot, then slowly got to his feet. As he turned, Tom saw his face fully in the sunlight. It was Clawson. What happened then was too fast for the eye to follow. Somebody must have spoken, but who did not matter. Clawson's gun was drawn, and he was starting to swing it up. Laredo Shad, in a gunman's crouch, flashed his right-hand gun. It sprang clear, froze for a long instant, and then, just as Clawson fired, Shad fired, but a split second sooner. Clawson staggered a step back, and Shad fired again. The outlaw went down slowly, and Laredo walked forward and stripped his gun belts from him. Then, from his horse, he took his saddlebags, rifle, and ammunition. Gathering up the dead man, and working with Connie's help, they tied him to the saddle, and then turned the horse loose with a slap on the hip. Connie Duane's face was white when she came into the room.
You saw that?
He nodded. We didn't dare let him go. If we had, we would all have been dead before noon tomorrow. Now, he said with grim satisfaction, they have something to think about. Shad grinned at him when he came in. I didn't see that gun he had drawed, he said ruefully. Had it laying along his leg as he was crouched there. Might have got me. He dropped the saddlebags. Might have grub, he said, and some shells. I reckon we can use them even though we have some. The message got off, and so did the letter. Feller over to the telegraph office was asking a powerful lot of questions. Seems like they've been hearing about this scrape. Good. The more the better. We can stand it, but the company can't. Hear anything? Uh-huh. Somebody from outside the state is starting a row about Gunder's death. I hear they may have marked you for that. That is, the company is saying you did it. Kedrick nodded. They would try that. Well, in a couple days I'll be out of here, and then we'll see what can be done. You take some time, Shad said, dubiously. That passel of thieves ain't going to find us. Although, he said suddenly, saw the tracks of that Gruya day afore yesterday, and not far off. The Gruya. Again. 11. 2 more days drifted by, and Tom Kedrick ventured down the trail and the ladders to the canyon below with Laredo, and visited their horses concealed in a tiny glade not far away. The Appaloosa nickered and trotted toward him, and Kedrick grinned and scratched his chest. How's it, boy? Ready to go places? He's asking for it, Shad said. He lighted a smoke and squinted his eyes at Kedrick. What do you aim to do when you do move? Ride around a little. I aim to see Pitt Lane, and then I'm going to start hunting up every mother's son that was in that dry gulching. Especially, he added, Dorney Shaw. He's bad, Laredo said quietly. I never seen it, but you ask Connie. Shaw's chained lightning. She seen him kill Bob. So, one of us dies, Kedrick said quietly. I'd go willingly enough to take him with me, and a few others. That's it. He's a killer, but the old bull of that woods is Alton Berwick. Believe me, he is. Keith is just right-hand man for him, and the fall guy if they need one. Berwick's the poison mean one. With Connie, they made their start 3 days later and rode back trails beyond the rim to the hideout Lane had established. It was Day Reed himself who stopped them, and his eyes lighted up when he saw Kedrick. Ha, oh, Tom, his broad face beamed. Like my own son you are. We'd heard you were kilt dead. Pitt Lane was standing by the fire, and around him on the ground were a dozen men, most of whom Kedrick recognized. They sat up slowly as the three walked into the open space, and Pitt turned. It was the first time Kedrick had seen him, and he was surprised. He was scarcely taller than his sister, but wide in the shoulders and slim in the hips. When he turned, he faced them squarely, and his eyes were sharp and bitter. This was a killing man, Kedrick decided, as dangerous in his own way as that pocket-sized devil Dorney Shaw. I'm Kedrick, he said.
and this is Connie Duane. I believe you know Shad.
We know all of you, Lane watched them, his eyes alert and curious.
Quietly and concisely, Kedrick explained, and ended by saying,
So, there it is. I've asked this friend of mine to start an investigation into the whole mess, and to block the sale until the truth is clear. Once the sale is blocked and that investigation started, they won't be with us long. They could get away with this only if they could keep it covered up, and they had a fair chance of doing that.
So we wait and let them run off? Lane demanded.
No. Tom Kedrick shook his head decidedly. We ride into Mustang, all of us. They have the mayor and the sheriff, but public opinion is largely on our side. Furthermore, he said quietly, we ride in the minute they get the news the sale is blocked. Once that news is around town, they'll have no friends. The bandwagon riders will get off, and fast.
They'll be shooting,
one old-timer opined.
Some, Kedrick admitted. But if I have my way, there'll be more of hanging. There's killers in that town, the bunch of Dry Gulch Steelman and Slagle. The man who killed Bob McLennan is the man I want.
Pit Lane turned.
I want him. Sorry, Lane. He killed Bob, and Bob was only in town to get a doc for me.
You may, he added, get your chance anyway.
I'd like a shot at him my own self, Laredo said quietly. But something else bothers me. Who's this Gruya rider? Is he one of you?
Gets around plenty, the old-timer said, but nobody ever sees him. I reckon he knows this here country better than any of us. He must have been around here for a long time.
What's he want? Shad wondered aloud.
That don't figure.
Kedrick shrugged. I'd like to know. He turned to Day.
It's good to see you. I was afraid you'd had trouble.
Trouble?
Day smiled his wide smile.
That's trouble, you say? All my life there's been trouble. And where a man is, there will be trouble to the end of time. If not of one kind, then another. But I take my trouble as it comes.
He drew deeply on his short-stemmed pipe and glanced at the scar around Kedrick's skull.
Looks like you'd a bit of it yourself. If you had a less hard skull, you'd now be dead.
I'd have not given a plug peso for him when I saw him,
Laredo said dryly.
The three of them, lying there, bloody and shot up. We thought for sure they was all dead. Listen, he'd a hole through him, low down and mean, and that head of his looked like it had been smashed until we moved him. He was lucky as well as thick-skulled.
Morning found Laredo and Kedrick once more in the saddle. Connie Duane had stayed behind with some of the squatter's women. Together, the two men were pushing on toward Mustang, but taking their time, for they had no desire to be seen or approached by any of the company riders.
There's nothing much we can do, Kedrick agreed, but I want to know the lay of the land in town. It's mighty important to be able to figure out what will happen when the news hits the place. Right now, everything is right for them. Alton Berwick and Lauren Keith are better off than they ever were. Just size it up. They came in here with the land partly held by squatters with a good claim on the land. That land they managed to get surveyed, and they put in their claim to the best of it, posted the notices, and waited them out. If somebody hadn't seen one of those notices and read it, the whole sale might have gone through and nobody the wiser. Somebody did see it, and trouble started. They had two mighty able men to contend with, Slagle and McLennan. Well, both of them are dead now. And Steelman, another possible leader, is dead too. So far as they are aware, nobody knows anything about the deaths of those men or who caused them. I was the one man they had learned they couldn't depend on, and they think I'm dead. John Gunter brought money into the deal, and he's dead and out of the picture completely. A few days more and the sale goes through. The land becomes theirs, and there isn't any organized opposition now. Pit Lane and his group will be named as outlaws and hunted as such, and believe me, once the land sale goes through, Keith will be hunting them with a posse of killers.
Yeah, Laredo drawled. They sure got it sewed up, looks like. But you're forgetting one thing. You're forgetting the girl, Connie Duane.
What about her?
Look, Shad said,
speaking around his cigarette. She sloped out of town right after McLennan was killed. They thought she had been talking to you before, and she told him off in the office, said she was getting her money out of it. All right? So, suppose she asks for it, and they can't pay. Suppose, he added, she begins to talk and tells what she knows, and they must figure it's plenty. She was Gunner's niece, and for all they knew, he told her more than he did tell her. You mean they'll try to get hold of her? What do you think? They'll try to get hold of her. Or kill her. Tom Kedrick's eyes narrowed. She'll be safe with Lane, he said. But an element of doubt was in his voice. That's a good crowd. Shad shrugged.
Maybe. Don't forget that Singer was one of them. But he didn't hesitate to try to kill Sloan, or to point him out for Abe Mixes. He was bought off by the company. So maybe there are others.
At that very moment, in the office of the Greystone building, such a man sat opposite Alton Berwick, while Keith sat in a chair against the wall. The man's name was Hurst. His face was sallow, but determined.